Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, January 9th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Eureka Council greenlights police drone research, Schmidt Q&A, Soham lawyer on ice, and Ray Hamill with the sports report. Stay tuned, those stories and more, coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Eureka will look into a controversial addition to its policing equipment, aerial drones. Daniel Mintz reports.
The Eureka City Council recognizes there's controversy over police use of drones, but has authorized research that could lead to approving it. The authorization was given following a mostly anti-drone public comment period at the January 6th council meeting. Unmanned aerial systems, drones, are categorized as military equipment and can't be acquired without council approval. But the Eureka Police Department has been using drones provided by the County Sheriff's Office, which is allowable as long as the use is reported to the council and the public. But Eureka Police Chief Brian Stevens said borrowing drones is, quote, not always the most efficient way to do things, especially in circumstances where time is of the essence. The ask before council was only to research the administrative structure, equipment, and cost related to developing the city's own drone program. Stevens described drones as a means of enhancing public safety and de-escalation.
These vehicles become a very valuable public safety tool, both used by law enforcement and other entities throughout California. They include fire, public works, anyone that deals with large areas, and they need to cover it in a quick amount of time and get a view that you don't get from the ground. They've been very valuable. They enhance officer safety and community safety by providing real-time situational awareness and supporting de-escalation during critical incidents. Under California state law, police officers are required, whenever feasible, to use de-escalation techniques before we use force, and especially in deadly force. And this is just another tool that will help us limit the number of armed confrontations that we have. And that's what we try to do. And we've seen results of those as recent as a couple months ago during a barricaded subject that we have. Additionally, we rely on these for to assist in mental health crisis when people are involving self-harm or suicidal tendencies. Mental health crisis, potentially armed individuals, searches for missing or at-risk individuals, persons, including children and adults, barricaded suspect situations requiring interior or aerial assessment and assistance, and then public safety incidents near schools or densely populated areas.
But during a lengthy public comment period, many speakers, like this one, said a drone program could be expanded and become intrusive.
The officer before just gave some very narrow examples of how the drones would be used, but I'd actually like to know how the drones would actually be used day to day and not just in the outliers. Because the answer is pretty obvious to anyone with eyes. The answer is it's going to be used for over-policing. As the previous person who was just up here stated, they were not just used in these very nice, just for helping people out kind of ways. And it's an established fact that over-policing just creates more poverty.
Other speakers said that drones are, quote, incredibly scary rather than de-escalating, and use of drones to monitor protests is a concern. But a few supported a drone program, including a woman who identified herself as an adult on the autism spectrum and said while she doesn't like the idea of being approached by a drone, quote, I would prefer it over being approached by an armed officer. Councilmember Leslie Castellano said use of sheriff's office drones, which is done under that office's policies, creates structural tensions that can be resolved by giving the city ultimate control.
In terms of the citizens who spoke to the, we may open a Pandora's box. In my mind, the Pandora's box has already been opened, but there is no direct line of oversight or accountability into that Pandora's box. And so, in some ways, in many ways, I support and applaud the work that our chief of police has done, as well as the oversight body and council, in terms of creating more opportunities for public awareness and education and learning around police practices. I do believe that this is a good exercise of democracy, is to have policies that people can actually have input on versus policies that people do not have input on.
Councilmember Katie Moulton shares concerns expressed during public comment about how a future version of the council may modify a drone program, but emphasized that the only move being made is to research a drone program, and she sees potential for it. Though Councilmember Mario Fernandez has, quote, a degree of ambivalence towards this, given the misuse or potential misuse and abuse versus the perks, he said a council-approved program would open, quote, accountability for our police department. Councilmember Scott Bauer said although there's a lot of mistrust of law enforcement, Eureka police officers are, quote, actually great human beings. But he also called for limits on police drone use, saying, quote, I don't want to see a drone flying over Friday night market. Approval of the research authorization was unanimous, and once the research is done, a proposal for a drone program will come back to council for consideration. Also at the meeting, many of those who spoke against the use of drones also supported a resolution opposing U.S. actions in and related to Venezuela during a general public comment period. A council resolution was to be taken up at a meeting last month, but it was canceled due to lack of a quorum. But Mayor Kim Burgell said the resolution will be on the agenda of the next meeting. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On June 25th of 2025, human remains were recovered from the Eel River. While a positive identification is still pending, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office provides an update on their findings. Nat Cardos reports.
On June 25th of last year, human remains were recovered from the Eel River near the Williams Grove Day Use area in Myers Flat along the Avenue of the Giants. The remains were located on the river bar, reportedly by a student participating in a watershed program that was snorkeling in the river. KMUD News spoke with Aaron Inskip, Public Information Officer for the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, for more information.
The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office is providing an update to the public regarding the unidentified human remains that were recovered on the Eel River on June 25th, 2025, near the Williams Grove Day Use area in Myers Flat. The remains were submitted to the Chico State Human Identification Laboratory for examination and analysis. A simplified summary of the findings are that the remains were determined to be of a male, believed to be middle-aged or older, with an estimated height of 5'5" to 5'11" tall. The examination revealed very poor oral health, with evidence of at least 19 teeth that were lost prior to death. The remaining teeth showed signs of dental restorations, indicating the individual received dental care at some point in their life. Degenerative changes were also observed in the skeletal remains, suggesting the individual may have experienced chronic pain or difficulty with mobility. One possible explanation for the changes could be rheumatoid arthritis, although this can't be confirmed. No major trauma was identified on the recovered remains. However, this does not exclude the possibility of soft tissue injury that would have not been detectable through skeletal analysis. At this time, the cause and manner of death remains undetermined. The individual has not yet been positively identified. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office continues to investigate this case and is seeking assistance from the public. Anyone with information regarding a missing person who may match the description or who has information that may assist in this investigation is encouraged to contact the Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251 or the Sheriff's Crime Tip line at 707-268-2539 and reference case number 20250271.
KMUD News will continue to provide updates as more information becomes available. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.
As outrage grows over the fatal shooting of a Minneapolis woman by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer, civil rights attorney Mark Reichel is speaking out and warning that the killing raises serious constitutional concerns about ICE authority and the use of deadly force. Reichel, a founding member of the ACLU Sacramento chapter and an attorney with more than 3 decades of experience in constitutional and civil rights law, says video evidence shows the woman was acting within her legal rights and posed no lawful justification for lethal force. He spoke with KPFA's Lauren Schmidt.
Mark, thank you for joining us on KPFA News. As a civil rights attorney, you've been outspoken after watching video of the killing of Renee Good in Minnesota. You noted that Good was likely within her legal rights and noted that ICE generally cannot arrest a U.S. citizen unless there is probable cause that that person is harboring an undocumented individual. You've also stated that even regular police would not be justified in using deadly force against someone who is fleeing. From a legal standpoint, can you walk us through what happened yesterday and why you believe the shooting was unlawful?
Their written policy disallows them from firing their weapon at a vehicle that's exiting. Number two, their written policy and their training also requires them to take the facts and circumstances of each incident into the equation. This officer that did the firing had a cell phone in his hand, and he was circling her vehicle, taking a video of her. He then steps to the he's in front of her vehicle, getting his gun out. He then steps to the side. He's definitely to the side. The angle of the shot shows where it came from, and you can't change that. So the angle through the windshield comes from the left of the windshield. If you're looking out the windshield, to the left. If you're looking at the windshield, it comes to the right. And the angle shows where he fired from. Not only that, the video shows where he fired from. He's not in front of her vehicle. He's to the left of her vehicle. Her wheels are turned to the right. He's turning to the right and moving away from him. And he stands back against his policy and fires the three shots. There's just no two ways about it, that it was illegal, that it violates their own policy. It violates the law in the state of Minnesota anyway. And it's an unjustified shooting that results in the death. That is a definition of murder.
We've seen a troubling pattern in ICE-involved shootings where initial federal claims are later contradicted by video, like in Chicago and in Los Angeles, where charges were just dropped after video contradicted agents' accounts, including evidence that an ICE officer accidentally discharged his weapon, striking an individual. Can you talk about this pattern and whether ICE is operating with impunity? And if so, how?
This will happen tomorrow. This probably happened a month ago. It will continue to happen under the Trump administration. There's just no dispute. There really is no longer the rule of law in America. And I don't say that casually. There's a hole in the Constitution that really has been exposed by MAGA. Specifically, the executive branch has all the power because they have all the guns, basically. It's actually that simple. So when they got together for the Constitutional Convention in 1788, they locked themselves in, you know, for a year in Philadelphia. There was all sorts of fights, you know, they had fist fights and so forth, and they did everything. But at the end of the day, they had to finish. They had to come up with a document. And what was left was what to do about the possibility of a despotic executive branch, because when it comes down to it, not everything can be decided by the courts. Not everything can be done by Congress. You have to have some trust. You know, you have to have some type of trust in an executive branch to administer things. And they gave the executive branch basically all the power because they truly believed Americans would never want a monarchy again, because the sacrifice to create the country in 1776 was immense. It was like something you hard to imagine, actually, brother versus brother and so forth. And they're giving up everything to do this. And they really did believe for the first time really in, you know, history of civilization that, you know, never a monarchy again, I mean, at all. And so they didn't think that Americans would countenance a despot or a monarch. But what they didn't realize that the country would get so big, you know, from the original 13 colonies, that it would get so big and stretch across the country like this, that, you know, it could get to the point where about 40% of the people do want a monarchy. They do want to be led. Freedom means responsibility. And that's why a lot of people dread it. And so what's happened here is, at some point, if all the smartest minds on earth got together and wanted to create a constitution to govern a country, you are going to be left with a difficult check and balance on the executive branch when they're the only ones that have, you know, a standing army or control the military. And you know, I'll just tell you my firm belief, like what Mao one time said prophetically in the 40s, was that all power stems from the barrel of a gun. And what he's really saying is there are no, you know, there's no real morality. There's no, you know, principles. It's all about facts. And it's about, you know, power is facts. And those who have the guns really have the power. What can this, if the Supreme Court right now said Trump is illegal and, you know, he can no longer operate. I mean, Stephen Miller, they're very clear. MAGA is very clear. That's irrelevant to them. So, you know, everybody says, oh, when the Democrats take over the House and if the Democrats take over the Senate, that's irrelevant to MAGA. What can the House do? They don't have an army. I mean, they can say, oh, they'll cut off the budget. Trump would just order the marshals to go to the bank and at gunpoint order the bankers to wire the money to the federal government, you know? So my point is there's a huge hole in our Constitution that the MAGA group under Trump has identified.
And finally, the head of Minnesota's state investigations agency says the U.S. Attorney's Office has barred it from participating in the investigation into the fatal shooting of Minneapolis resident Renee Good by an ICE officer, leaving the case solely in the hands of the FBI under Trump loyalist Kash Patel. Given that, what should the public realistically expect from this investigation?
He will not be charged. They've spirited him out of Minnesota. Even if the state of Minnesota charges him, it would be up to the feds to surrender him, and they would never do that. And if they were required, if they felt that they had to, they would remove the case to federal court under 28 USC 1442 and make it a federal case, and they would then dismiss the charges because then the federal government is in charge of the prosecution. If you think otherwise, good Lord, are you not paying attention to what's going on? So they understand that they have all the power. They understand it's unchecked, and they understand that factually, short of an armed revolution, it cannot be checked. Congress can't do anything. The Supreme Court can't do anything. And so they know they can do whatever they want. They say that every day.
Ray Hamill brings us details of all this week's big local sports stories, including why it was an exciting start to the Big Five in boys basketball, all the latest high school and college basketball news, why it's been a very impressive start to the conference play for the Cal Poly Humboldt women, and how the HDNL is dealing with inappropriate behavior by league spectators.
It was an exciting start to the Big Five in boys basketball this week, with an entertaining showdown at McKinleyville High School and a thrilling finish in Crescent City. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the opening week in the Big Five in just a moment, as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest high school basketball news from around the North Coast, as well as news of why it's been a great start to conference play for the Cal Poly Humboldt women's basketball team, all the latest from College of the Redwoods, and why the HDNL is once again calling for better sportsmanship in the stands at league events. But first up, it was a fun start to the Big Five in boys basketball on Tuesday night. In what is expected to be a wide open race for the conference championship, two of the front runners met at McKinleyville High School as the Panthers hosted Eureka in a competitive game with little to separate the two schools for much of the night. The Panthers, however, would pull away late and held on for a 73-67 victory. The game in Del Norte, meanwhile, featured a thrilling finish. The host Warriors led for much of the night, but the Tigers took their first lead of the game in the final minute and appeared to be headed for victory. Junior Justin Cushman and the Warriors, however, had other ideas and pulled out a 62-61 victory on a buzzer-beating three-pointer as time expired, before the home fans stormed the court to celebrate with the players and coaches. The Big Five girls teams opened conference play on Wednesday night, and it was a good start for Arcata and Eureka. The defending champion Tigers traveled to Crescent City and came away with a 65-50 win to begin the defense of their championship. Senior Mae Wolfert, who is the reigning co-MVP of the Big Five with her twin sister Tay, had a big night in the win and finished with 20 points, 9 rebounds and 8 steals. At Jay Willard Gymnasium in Eureka, the host Loggers started fast in their game against the Panthers and would take a comfortable 46-33 win as they look to retake the championship they last won 2 years ago. The Eureka girls, who held the visitors to just 8 first-half points and led by 21 at halftime, were led by senior Nashaya Williams, who was playing at an MVP level this winter and scored 12 points to continue her impressive season. The Big Five girls will be back in action on Friday night as the Tigers try to go to 2-0 in conference when they host a Fortuna team that has impressed over the first half of the season. The Huskies made it 7 straight wins with a 45-30 non-conference victory over neighbor Ferndale on Tuesday night. Freshman Kalea Parkinson led the Fortuna girls in scoring with 9 points, but it was the team defense that really paved the way to victory by holding the Wildcats to their lowest points tally of the season. With the win, the Huskies improved to 13-3 as they get set to tip off their conference schedule this weekend. The 11-6 Wildcats will be back in action on Friday night when they open the Little Four with a challenging trip to play defending conference champs St. Bernard's. The Crusaders have been one of the most impressive teams in the HDNL over the first half of the season and are 10-4 as they get set to begin conference play. Also in the Little Four on Friday night, the South Fork girls will travel to play Hoopa. In local college basketball, meanwhile, both College of the Redwoods teams enjoyed a winning start to the Golden Valley Conference on Wednesday night. The Corsairs traveled to Reading to play Shasta College in a doubleheader, with the CR women getting the night started with a 57-51 win. The always impressive Nora Talty led CR with a double-double, finishing with 16 points, 11 rebounds and 5 assists. With the win, the Redwoods women improved to 1-0 in conference and 9-8 overall. The CR men followed with an 82-70 win over the Knights, improving to 1-0 in the GVC and 12-7 overall. Former South Fork Cub Tommy Rotbergs led the way at both ends of the floor as Redwoods overcame a 4-point halftime deficit with a big second half. The freshman guard, whom head coach Justin Kloss said had his best game of the season, finished with 10 points and played some very strong defense. Both CR teams will continue conference play this weekend when they host Butte College in a doubleheader on Saturday afternoon, with the women getting the action started at 1 p.m. and the men following at 3. The Cal Poly Humboldt basketball teams were also in action this week as each continued its impressive run in the California Collegiate Athletic Association. The Humboldt women won a pair of games at Lumberjack Arena against Cal State Dominguez Hills and Cal State Los Angeles, including a 74-73 win over the latter on Sunday to go to 6-0 in conference play and 8-4 overall. The start to conference is the team's best since 2014, as the Jacks remained deadlocked atop the standings with Cal Poly Pomona and Chico State. The Humboldt men also swept 2 games against Dominguez Hills and Los Angeles, overcoming an 11-point deficit against the latter to secure a 75-72 victory. The victory was the 3rd straight for the Jacks, who improved to 6-6 overall and 4-2 in conference, moving into a tie for 2nd in the standings. Both Cal Poly Humboldt teams will be back in action at Cal State East Bay on Saturday. And rounding out a busy week in local sports, HDNL Commissioner Jack Lakin has written an open letter to the North Coast sports community asking once again for better sportsmanship by the league fans. The fall sports season resulted in multiple fans being banned from league events due to inappropriate behaviour, most notably with the officials, including one fan who has been banned from attending any high school events in California for life after physically threatening a league official. The league has introduced a new bylaw banning any ejected spectator who refuses to leave the site of a sporting event for 1 year. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes are raising concerns about ICE activity and the safety of their tribal citizens living in the Twin Cities after 37-year-old Renee Good was fatally shot by an ICE agent Wednesday in South Minneapolis. The Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, White Earth Nation, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and Red Lake Nation have issued releases expressing remorse for Good and her family. A number of Native groups have also extended their condolences, including the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition and Native Women Running. The restaurant Owamni by sous chef Sean Sherman in Minneapolis closed after the shooting. In a social media post, it said it will reopen with a portion of sales this weekend being donated to Good's family. Tribes are encouraging their citizens to report any interactions with ICE to them. To be mindful of their surroundings, carry identification, including tribal IDs, and to check in on elders and relatives in the Twin Cities. The Red Lake Nation is condemning the shooting, saying President Trump must be held accountable for his, quote, war of retribution, and that it has 8,000 members living in the Twin Cities where, quote, ICE is presently terrorizing residents. The Trump administration is justifying the shooting while city and state leaders disagree. The mayor wants ICE to get out of Minneapolis, and so does Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, who's White Earth. On national television during an interview with ABC News Thursday night, Flanagan said it's time for ICE to get out of Minnesota, to leave them alone, and that enough is enough. Meanwhile, in South Dakota, the Oglala Sioux tribe is also raising concerns about its tribal citizens living in the Twin Cities. In an advisory to tribal citizens, OST President Frank Starkumsout said he has been made aware that ICE detained 4 of their tribal members in Minneapolis. He said tribal attorneys have been instructed to reach out to Flanagan and work toward their release. The advisory to Oglala Lakota citizens also includes how to handle ICE interactions and to contact Starkumsout or other officials with the tribe immediately. A Portland organization involved with missing and murdered Indigenous people awareness and advocacy is holding volunteer training. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on what people should expect should they participate in MMIP events.
For roughly a year and a half, MMIW Search and Hope Alliance has conducted searches and events that support their community. Founder Kimberly Linning says they rely heavily on volunteers to get things done across the region. Besides being physically fit for hiking, marches, and distributing materials, Linning says it's also important that people are emotionally mature and tough.
How they handle stress, how they handle dealing with confrontation, because a lot of times we're dealing with devastated families. Sometimes their anger can be directed at us, and it's not personal. It's because the families are under so much pressure.
Linning says a common misperception is that volunteering with groups like hers is some kind of true crime adventure, or that all they do is search for bodies. She says most MMIP cases result in finding people who are alive, but even then, there can be challenging situations.
A lot of times, they're struggling from an addiction, so we kind of look at that aspect. Hey, do you need to get into detox? Would you like to go here? Do you want to speak to your family? We really encourage the missing that we find to call home, call their family, and we offer to give them that resource.
Volunteers with special skills such as scuba diving, rappelling, or operating drones are great, Linning adds. The MMIW Search and Hope Alliance's training will be held in Gresham, Oregon on January 10th. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Michael McCaskill, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Nat Cardos, Lauren Schmidt, Ray Hamill, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.